Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, this November 29th. 2009. Hope everyone's had a great holiday weekend or weekend. We have a terrific show for you today. We're going to be talking about the fate of the American economy and the American working class, the working people. We're going to talk to a veteran labor journalist and a labor activist. Should be an enlightening hour. We hope you'll be here to enjoy the hour with us. But before we go to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
As the Federal Communications Commission prepares a national broadband plan, Native Americans want to be part of the discussions. Tribal lands have been largely ignored by federal policymakers. A new study, New Media, Technology, and Internet Use in Indian Country, surveyed more than 120 tribes living in 28 states about how the Internet is being used for blogging, political research, driving directions, uploading photos and video, and text messaging. The results showed that Native Americans are using the Internet at higher rates than their counterparts in the rest of the country. But Tracy Morris of Native Public Media, who co-authored the report, points out that while Indians are using the Internet at higher rates, it doesn't mean they have easy access on Indian lands.
It does mean that the people are resourceful and they're finding ways to gain access, whether they're driving to hotspots, they're driving a long distance to hotspots, or whatever they're doing, they are reaching out and seeking access to the Internet in that way.
Loris Ann Taylor, executive director of Native Public Media, says that the six successful digital projects surveyed in the study are community-centric.
You have tribes here who are investing their own money into deploying broadband, because in many circumstances they don't qualify for the federal funds that are supposed to help deploy broadband out into rural and remote communities.
The tribes made sure that the major institutions like tribal government, schools, law enforcement, health centers, and radio stations were connected first. These projects, ranging from providing Internet service to building computers for the tribal members to creating digital communities, can serve as a model for other tribes as well as non-tribal communities. The study recommends the creation of a tribal broadband plan within the national broadband plan. It says tribal entities should help with planning and mapping. A national FCC Native Nations Broadband Task Force and a tribal office at the FCC are also recommended.
If you have 564 Native Nations in this country who are federally recognized, then more tribes that are going through the recognition process, then there's a real need for the FCC to have an office to make sure that there's some consultation going on with these nations.
To read the report, go to nativepublicmedia.org.
The debate over network neutrality, the fundamental principle that keeps Internet service providers from discriminating against lawful websites, content, or applications, has moved from the halls of Washington to city council agendas in New York and San Francisco. Last week, the New York City Council held a hearing on a resolution to back strong net neutrality protections to, quote, ensure that the Internet will continue to foster innovation, increase competition, and spur economic growth, as well as making the Internet faster and more affordable for all. Testifying at the meeting were several public interest advocates who discussed the significance of the city's resolution. Art Brodsky, Communications Director of Public Knowledge, was among them.
It's important to all the Internet users. It's important to all the Internet developers to have an open, vibrant, and non-discriminatory Internet. And to the extent that you can influence the Congress of the United States through your voice up here in this committee and the Council as a whole, you'll make a very good contribution to preserving that open environment, which is so important.
Also testifying was Tim Carr, Campaign Director of Free Press. He presented the council with over 4,000 signatures from concerned New Yorkers who support net neutrality.
Much is at stake for the tens of millions of Americans who rely upon the internet every day. Despite the debate, I don't believe anyone on this panel or in this room would dispute two notions. First, over the past 40 years, the internet has emerged as an unprecedented tool for spreading innovative ideas, increasing public participation in our democracy, fostering economic opportunity, even in the most overlooked communities. Second, I don't believe we would disagree that we need sound public policies to encourage faster, more open, and affordable internet access for everyone in the country. We need to pass the right policies right now.
Brodsky warned the council not to get distracted.
You'll hear a lot of things about the threats to the economy from net neutrality. You hear a lot of probably some engineering mumbo jumbo about how you can't have a non-discriminatory internet. All net neutrality means is you can't play favorites.
San Francisco is considering a similar resolution in support of net neutrality. Both city councils are expected to vote on the resolutions in the coming weeks. To learn more about net neutrality, visit savetheinternet.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, November 29th, 2009. Today we have a show I've been looking forward to for a long time. Our guest today is a veteran labor lawyer, labor activist, and journalist who's written widely for just about every publication that covers the labor movement, every major newspaper in the country, and has put together a brand new book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. Steve Early, welcome to Media Matters. Hello, Steve. I guess we're still making our connection with our guest. So while we're working with that, Steve, are you there? Okay. Well, again, this is Bob McChesney. This is November 29th, 2009. And while we're waiting for our guests to connect with us and getting some word from our engineer what the status is, let's talk a little bit, if I can, about some of the upcoming guests that we're planning to have on the program in the weeks and months ahead, and some of the guests we've had on recently. Last week's program, of course, was Barbara Ehrenreich, and we've gotten a lot of very positive feedback about that show on Brightsided. The week before that, we had Max Blumenthal on the air talking about his book, Republican Gomorrah, and the response to that show as well was very strong. And let's go back now and see again if we can get our guest. Steve Early, are you there? Unfortunately, I cannot pick up our guest. Apparently, he's there, but it's just the connection to my headphone is not working properly. Steve? I think, unfortunately, unless this gets fixed, we're going to have to go to one of our pre-recorded shows. Let's see if we can get this done sooner rather than later. I'm waiting for word from the control studio. Steve Early, our guest, is trying furtively to be in touch with me, apparently, but I have no such luck. And I think what we're going to do now is go to a musical interlude and then pick up in a second. So I'll turn it over to... hello, Steve. Oh. Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you today with a show we've been looking forward to for some time. We have as our guest Peter Richardson, the author of a brand new book, A Bomb in Every Issue: How the Short, Unruly Life of Rampart's Magazine Changed America. Peter Richardson is the editorial director of Polypoint Press, and he's also the chair of the California Studies Association. His previous book was American Prophet, The Life and Work of Kerry McWilliams. We're delighted to welcome Peter Richardson to our phone lines for today's program on Media Matters. Peter, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
First of all, I enjoyed the book a great deal, and I should add that the book is published by New Press and has just been released. I think the obvious question that comes up when you see a history of a magazine like Ramparts in a period like the 1960s is why you thought this would be a good topic for a book. What was your personal interest in it?
It's funny, I really didn't know much about Ramparts magazine, even though I grew up here in the Bay Area, which is where the magazine launched in 1962. I was born 3 years earlier, and it completely eluded me, even though I'm interested in these topics and should have known about it, I thought. That was actually my same interest in Kerry McWilliams. Why didn't I know about this guy? So it actually came up when I was researching the life and work of Kerry McWilliams. Many of his younger colleagues had written for Ramparts, and I got a little bit curious about it, and then my work at Polypoint Press introduced me to a lot of Ramparts veterans like Larry Bensky, who was on Pacifica Radio for many years, Reese Ehrlich, who's published a couple of books with Polypoint Press, and I just wanted to know more about it. And then once I was listening to a presentation on the history of KPFA radio that was being offered by Gene Marine, and I knew Gene had written for Ramparts, and I also knew that there were already a couple of books on the history of KPFA, but I wasn't aware of any books on the history of Ramparts, and I wanted to know more about it. So I just, after the presentation, I just quizzed everybody in the room and said, is there anything to read on Ramparts magazine? And nobody could really come up with anything. And I thought, wow, this is strange, you know, because I used to be an English professor, and it just seemed like all the works that we taught in these literature classes, you know, there were thousands of books about these things, you know, and who wanted to write the 2,000th book about Beowulf? Here was a topic that was really ripe and that I was very personally interested in, and I got more interested in it personally because I realized as I was doing the research on this project that Ramparts was shaped by and also helped to shape the world that I was born into, literally. I was born in Berkeley in 1959, and it was like, you know, like everybody, when you're born into the world and, you know, you miss the first half of the movie in a way, right? I mean, I didn't know anything about it, and yet I realized that that Ramparts had done a great deal to shape the Bay Area, and especially its media.
Now, Peter, you mentioned Kerry McWilliams, and I suspect there are a lot of our listeners who, like you, before you did the work on Kerry McWilliams, are unfamiliar with his name and his history. Can you just briefly let people know who Kerry McWilliams was?
Yeah, Kerry McWilliams was a Los Angeles author and activist, a very prolific author, very shrewd observer of the national political scene, but an especially shrewd observer of California culture and politics. He wrote a book called Factory in the Fields, which was kind of the nonfiction version of The Grapes of Wrath. That came out the same year, actually, 1939. And then he wrote about a book a year, really astonishing stuff. He wrote about the Japanese internment. He wrote about race. He wrote about labor. He wrote about McCarthyism. And he continued doing that until the early 50s when he joined the staff of The Nation, where he eventually became the executive editor. And he guided The Nation through a very turbulent time for the magazine, the McCarthy period, and then finally retired in 1975. And so he was another person who had sort of slipped off the public radar. And, you know, when you come upon people like that, at least I like, yeah, I want to know more about them. So both projects had that in common. I just thought, gee, I really should know more about this person. And then you get the feeling like, you know, you want to tell other people about them too.
How would you, for listeners unaware of Ramparts Magazine, the subject of your book, but who are familiar with The Nation today, was Ramparts Magazine pretty much like The Nation, if they were to pick up a copy today, in sort of tone and format and style, or was it different?
It was very different, and I was kind of attracted to that difference. The Nation, under Kerry McWilliams, wasn't that different from The Nation today. It was a weekly. It was printed on newsprint. It had a lot of opinion and analysis. It had some news. Kerry McWilliams turned it into a forum for investigative reporting, for sure. It wasn't that before he came on board in any important way, I don't think. He brought that to the magazine, and it's still there. But Ramparts was glossier. It was more sensational. It had a higher circulation, and I would say a kind of higher impact. It was much more tuned in to how the media worked, and it was much better at compelling larger news organizations, especially the New York Times, to pick up its stories. So it tended to go for the bigger blockbuster stories, and it was a monthly, not a weekly.
You know, I was I came of age in the '60s, being born in December of 1952 in Cleveland, Ohio, and I knew nothing of The Nation until I got to college in the early 70s, but I certainly was well aware of Ramparts throughout its history. And this is not, you know, I wasn't in any sort of politically active family that was subscribing to it, but it really permeated the broader media culture and political culture because it was just part of the news.
Yeah, and it was, I think, even more than The Nation, it was the premier muckraking magazine of that period. It didn't start that way. It started as a Catholic literary quarterly, but very quickly morphed into a muckraker. Warren Hinkle, the addition of Warren Hinkle helped that along, but the addition of Robert Scheer, I think, was even more important. Also, art director Dougald Sturmer, who gave the magazine this kind of memorable, high-impact look. And those three, along with founding publisher Ed Keating, were sort of the band for a little while, and they really rocked the house for several years. The money never quite added up, and that we can talk maybe a little bit about that later.
Yeah, definitely.
The business model is always a challenge when it comes to investigative reporting, but they had a knack for getting that story, which, as Hunter Thompson said, had a high, weird look to it. And Hunter Thompson was sort of part of this extended Ramparts family as well, especially when he was living in San Francisco.
You know, as you were doing your work on the book, Peter Richardson, did you learn something not only about Ramparts but about the '60s that, you know, you didn't know before? Did you dispel some misconceptions you might have had about that era in American history?
Yeah, I think so. I think there is some way, you know, anytime you press down on a particular outfit or group, you realize that, you know, this could have been otherwise. It didn't have to be this way. That there were differences within the organization, differences in emphasis, differences in personal style. I think what made Ramparts work was that the principal people at the magazine during its heyday and even afterwards, that there was a productive tension there. Hinkle was not a leftist. Neither was Dougald Sturmer. They were rebels. Scheer was a leftist. And that I think Hinkle and Sturmer kind of tempered Scheer, and in a way that made it possible to reach a broad audience. I think if Scheer had just been able to have it his way, or Hinkle, then it wouldn't have been as good as it was. Later, David Horowitz and Peter Collier took over the magazine, and it became narrower. It became a little bit more dogmatic. It was a tougher media climate, for sure. There were a lot of reasons why Ramparts didn't continue at this sort of high altitude. But, you know, it's all about the chemistry there. Another thing I learned was that Ramparts was not in any way sympathetic, really, even to the hippies in San Francisco during the Summer of Love, for example. There was a kind of, you know, arm's length relationship between Ramparts and the hippies, and the person who was able to tap that potential most, I think, was Jan Wenner, who was actually a Rampart staffer at the time. He combined with Ralph Gleason, who was a contributing editor and a music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, to start Rolling Stone magazine, which they mocked up, actually, in the Ramparts office in November 1967. So, you know, Ramparts was throwing off these other enterprises, one of which became very successful and is still around, Rolling Stone. Another one was Mother Jones, which was also started by Ramparts veterans.
Our guest on Media Matters today is Peter Richardson. You've just been listening to Peter Richardson is the author of the new book, A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America, just published by New Press. This is a pre-recorded program, so don't call in today. Let us do the talking for you. You can either sit back and relax or get active or do whatever you please, but just don't get on the phone lines. Peter Richardson, you know, let's go a little more into Ramparts itself, the magazine, what it did. And as you've pointed out, the real hallmark of Ramparts, what put it on the map, certainly brought it to the attention of people like myself, you know, the 14-year-olds in Cleveland, Ohio, was its muckraking and the stories it broke that no one else was covering. Talk a little bit about how it evolved into a muckraking journal and what some of the big stories were that it covered.
Well, it became a muckraker largely because Warren Hinkle brought that sensibility to this Catholic Literary Quarterly. So that was the first big shift in that direction. But it really didn't take until Robert Scheer came along. Scheer had been a graduate student at the Center for Chinese Studies at UC Berkeley. He had an interest in Cuba. He had an interest in China. And then he had a growing interest in Vietnam as the U.S. became more involved there. He went to Vietnam. He looked around. He saw what was happening. He felt it was that the story in Vietnam was being very badly misrepresented in the U.S. media, largely because it was a nationalist enterprise, and the insistence on framing it in Cold War terms was distorting what was actually going on the ground in Vietnam. And when he came back, he brought that story, and he gave it a kind of Catholic twist, which was appropriate because Ramparts was still largely a Catholic magazine at the time, by noting that the Catholic leaders in South Vietnam, who had the support of many influential Catholic leaders in the United States, including the Kennedys, was not doing a great job, and that the U.S. people weren't learning what was really going on there. So the first big muckraking story was actually based on research that Scheer did. Weirdly, he did that research not in Vietnam only, but he found some documents in the UC Berkeley library that led him to discover that the CIA was using a Michigan State University program as a kind of cover for some covert activity there, where they were training the South Vietnamese police. They were doing some interrogation, harsh interrogation, as the media today might say, that they were arming the South Vietnamese. And when he brought that story to Ramparts, which appeared in the April 1966 issue, it was huge. I mean, there hadn't been any real critical reporting on the CIA. The Nation had done some under Kerry McWilliams, but this was really the first time that people said, hey, what are we doing? You know, what's the CIA doing here? And the CIA didn't like it at all. They actually began unlawfully investigating Ramparts and its staff and its funders and everything else. So there was a legitimate interest there. I mean, they were allowed to probe if there were foreign funds that were going into Ramparts, but there weren't. And that was the only legitimate justification for that investigation. Even so, the CIA carried it on for years and developed some ways to screw up Ramparts. And they later said that they didn't need to use them, that Ramparts fell on its own. But the fact was, and this is all well documented, and you can actually go on the CIA website and see some of the documents that were being passed around about Ramparts. But that was a big story. That you know, really shocked a lot of people and sent sort of electrified the American left.
When did that story break, Peter?
Well, it appeared in the April 1966 issue, and the cover, and this is a kind of typical Rampart thing, the cover was actually an illustration of Madame New in a Michigan State University cheerleading outfit.
Now, who was Madame New for some of our listeners?
Madame New was married to the Vietnamese leader at the time, I believe the leader's brother, perhaps. Maybe you would know better. But that was a typical combination of sort of this, you know, visual imagination, deep irreverence, and a big, serious blockbuster story. So, you know, that was the kind of thing that the Nation wouldn't have done. They wouldn't have put an illustration of Madame New in a cheerleading outfit on the cover. So that was the first of many. There were other CIA stories later, the infiltration of and the funding of the National Student Association. That came out in March, I believe, of 1967. That was another stunner, that the CIA was funding all of these U.S. groups, labor unions, magazines, not right-wing at all in many cases, but just, you know, had a bunch of organizations on the payroll, and people were stunned to find that out. Some people later thought, hey, it was the most enlightened thing the CIA ever did. What's wrong with that? But most people felt like their groups had been compromised by that link, and so that was another big whistleblower story.
What sort of circulation numbers was Ramparts getting as it began to break these big stories in 65, 66, 67, into the late 60s?
It was about it had climbed to about 150,000, I think, after the April 66 story. By 67 and 68, it was up to about 250,000. It's an extraordinary period there through 1967. Their civil rights work and their anti-war stuff had really propelled them up about over a quarter of a million. And one example of its impact was, during that time, was that Martin Luther King Jr. read an issue which had a piece called The Children of Vietnam, which was a photo essay on the effects of U.S. bombing, including napalm bombing in Vietnam, on Vietnamese children. And, you know, he looked at that piece. He was actually in the airport at the time trying to eat lunch, and he just pushed his plate away and said, you know, I've got to come out against this war. It wasn't a popular move. His counselors were saying, you know, stay focused on civil rights. But he realized he had to speak out against the war, and he did, actually, in a big speech that he gave Riverside Church in New York exactly 1 year before his assassination. And Ramparts ran the text of that speech the following month. And that was when it was really hitting on all cylinders.
You know, that's an extraordinary story to demonstrate the importance of good journalism, of media, in influencing the course of events.
Yes, it was. I mean, it's not very often that you get these stories where a leader say, I changed my mind when I read a magazine story. But King was very open about that, and it was a matter of conscience for him. He knew that he needed to do this. Interestingly, Kerry McWilliams had invited him to do it as well. But he was still on the fence until he saw this photo essay, which was a very difficult piece to work on. The people at Ramparts, including art director Dugald Sturmer, said, you know, we were in tears putting this thing together.
Because the pictures were so stunning.
Because the pictures, yeah. And, I mean, if you think about the way Iraq or Afghanistan are being covered today, you know, a lot of the world, you know, they're seeing these pictures, and we're not seeing all of those pictures. That's how I understand it. For example, Al Jazeera is running film every day, showing the effects of bombing and fighting in those countries. And for the most part, Americans are not seeing those images. And I think that was something that was quite new. You were not seeing that. As one staffer I talked to put it, he was a former FBI agent who focused mostly on intelligence and JFK conspiracy stories and stuff like that. But he said, you know, you got to remember where were you going to see these stories? The Saturday Evening Post? I mean, they're just, you know, people were not covering it. Big media in particular was giving these stories a very wide berth, and Ramparts had to kind of goad them into covering these stories, but that's what happened.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Peter Richardson, the author of the new book, just published by New Press, A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America. We're pre-recording the show before going on air, so please don't call in today. Relax and let us do the talking, or get up and raise hell. Do whatever you want to do, but just don't get on the phone for the next hour, or it'll be a waste of your time. And I think this comes up in the book as one of the themes, with Scheer in particular, was that liberalism, or the left, or even the Democratic Party, to put a more moderate version of liberalism in the left, prior to Ramparts and prior to the mid-60s, say, had been in a very defensive position in the United States, and almost apologetic, the right clearly was on the march, and they were not. Not unlike the situation we've been in the last couple decades. And Ramparts represented sort of a complete sort of, like, reversal of that, and it seemed like it became the aggressor and setting the stage and forcing the discussion on the issues it wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of that did come from Scheer, who was not afraid of being called a communist. He felt like the McCarthy period in particular had put a kind of chill over the conversation and made the left less eager to come out and really name some of these problems and injustices and provide remedies. So he was quite willing to do that, and that fearlessness kind of changed the conversation. It didn't bother him if somebody called him a name. And when the Democratic Party was being tepid on the issues that he cared about, most notably the war in Vietnam, but others too, poverty, racism, you know, he called that out, and he actually used his position at Ramparts to run for Congress in the East Bay. And he made a surprisingly good run at a kind of mainstream Democrat. He lost. He got 46% of the vote in the Democratic primary. But it really sent a message to the Democratic Party. Hey, you know, you need to take care of these things. You know, it's not enough to just continue to run this war and maybe oppose racism in the South, but not racism in Oakland, California, for example. It's okay to support the farm workers, but what? How about right here in this district? So that was a big kind of liberating aspect. And Scheer would say we weren't trying to defend any ground. You know, we weren't linked to the Democratic Party, which was the party after 1964 that was maintaining and conducting the war. So that was very important to make that challenge and not just go along with this kind of Cold War liberalism, which had a lot of problems. Now, on the other hand, you know, looking back, you can see that they actually set the stage for some developments that they probably didn't want. Scheer would say, I think, now he did say to me that they overestimated the strength of the liberal consensus at that time. You know, so that figures like Pat Brown, who was the governor of California, didn't seem like these guys could lose to people like Ronald Reagan. You know, how can Pat Brown, who's a real politician, lose to this actor? You know, they didn't worry about that. But
Peter, if I understand you, you're saying that Robert Scheer and some of the other folks, perhaps, who worked at Ramparts at the time, later regretted sort of taking on the Democrats and the liberal establishment, assuming they had all the power, only discover that what replaced them was not to anyone to their left, but to their right.
Yeah, I didn't sense a lot of regret around it. I think they just felt like they miscalculated the appeal of people like Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't seem credible that he could, you know, become a two-term governor of California and then a two-term president of the United States. I mean, and nobody did. I mean, Jessica Mitford, who was a Ramparts contributor, reviewed Reagan's book, Where's the Rest of Me, in 1965, and she had a lot of fun with it. It's actually a really funny article to read now, but I do think they underestimated Reagan, and they overestimated the strength of the liberal consensus at that time.
Our guest, Peter Richardson, the book we're talking about, A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America. And as the subtitle says, Peter Richardson, it was a short and very unruly life of the magazine. And having been a magazine publisher, I winced as I read these stories about its ongoing, permanent, unresolvable financial crises. It was always in crisis, wasn't it?
It was, and it didn't have to be. Maybe I think there is a problem there with the business model for political magazines, and that goes for magazines on the left and the right. National Review has never made money. It's over 50 years old. The Nation rarely turns a profit in any particular year. Maybe they've been in the black 3 years out of 150 plus that they've been around, almost 150. So making money doesn't come with the territory here. You don't do these magazines for that reason. So you have to figure out a way to fund these things. Hinkle was an expert fundraiser. They got by for several years on founding publisher Edward Keating's money. Actually, the money came from his wife, Helen Keating, who was a heiress to a gypsum fortune and very much believed in this, but it was a money loser, and their money evaporated by the end of 1964, I think. Then they began recruiting investors, if you want to call it that. I don't think anybody actually thought they were going to make any money, but they liked being around it. I mean, Hinkle made it kind of glamorous and fun, and people wanted to be involved with that, and it was a challenge because they had this kind of splashy, expensive style. But that was also part of the appeal. When they tried to go cheap after their first bankruptcy, which was in January 1969, they went to newsprint, they went with the smaller budget. It didn't really help, mm-hmm. Because people like being around the high rollers, I think. So that was an ongoing challenge. It's still a challenge for political magazines today.
I'd like to go through some of the roster of people who worked at Ramparts or were connected with it in some way. It's an extraordinary list, and I won't even try to be exhaustive, but there are a handful of people who either would go on to play large roles or played a large role at Ramparts during its history that are also central in American politics or economics at the time. And you've talked about Robert Scheer, and he went on, of course, to be a columnist for the L.A. Times in the 90s and into this decade. And a fairly prominent sort of progressive journalist. Another person who plays a large role in your book and in the history of Ramparts is Eldridge Cleaver.
Right.
Talk a little bit about, and again, for some of our younger listeners who may not be too familiar with him, who Eldridge Cleaver was, what he did at Ramparts, and what his influence was in the publication and where he went afterwards.
Cleaver was in state prison at the time. And he began writing partly to generate attention and money so he could hire a lawyer to get out of prison. And he attracted the attention of a San Francisco radical lawyer named Beverly Axelrod, who knew Ramparts publisher Ed Keating. And she encouraged Keating to read his stuff, and he did, and they actually ran some stuff in the magazine while Cleaver was still in prison. And then they helped arrange his parole, or rather his release, and they put him on the masthead in December 1966. Within a couple of months, he was compiling his manuscript for Soul on Ice, which became a big bestseller, most of which consists of essays that he ran in Ramparts magazine. But only 3 months after he got out of prison, he asked Betty Shabazz, Malcolm X's widow, to come by the Ramparts office on 301 Broadway in San Francisco. What he didn't know, I don't think, was that Betty Shabazz had arranged for the Black Panthers to provide her security. So they showed up at the office, armed to the teeth, and really rattled the people in the office, but also alarmed many people in the neighborhood. And the San Francisco police came down, and there was a kind of standoff, an armed standoff between Huey Newton, the leader of the Black Panthers, and the San Francisco police, which ended when the police just kind of backed down. There was no violence or anything like that, but it electrified Eldridge Cleaver. I mean, there had been all this kind of jailhouse talk about revolution, armed revolution, and now he thought he was seeing the real thing. So he quickly became involved with the Black Panther Party, eventually became their Minister of Information, and also went up to Sacramento with them when they marched onto the state legislature, into the state legislature, again, armed to protest a new gun control law that they felt was targeting them. And that turned into a kind of media frenzy, and the Black Panthers became internationally recognized revolutionaries.
And again, for the sake of our listeners who might not recall this era or were not alive then, Eldridge Cleaver was a household name in the United States while he was working at Rampart. Soul and Ice was a book that, you know, was known across the country. It was at the top of the bestseller list. So it really vaulted, again, Ramparts into the very middle of American political culture.
Yeah, it did. It worked both ways. The Ramparts coverage of the Black Panthers made the Panthers celebrities, but the coverage also, their celebrity then began to increase the magazine's cachet. So the fate of the party and the magazine became more closely linked. And by the way, going back to the funding question, that was one of the things Hinkle would say later that made it hard to attract new funding. On the one hand, there was something kind of thrilling about what was going on. And I should also say that, you know, what was going on in Oakland at that time was frankly racist. I mean, the police actions in Oakland, the police activity in Oakland during that time in the Black neighborhoods of Oakland was atrocious. And you know, this was one response to that. And, of course, it's one that still survives in our culture. The Panthers still have this kind of iconic power, and a lot of that iconic power can be traced back to the Ramparts magazine's coverage of them.
Whatever happened to Eldridge Cleaver?
Well, he got involved in a shootout just after Martin Luther King's assassination, and that violated his parole, and he went to Cuba. And, you know, he smuggled out of the country, and then he ended up in Algeria and Paris, and then he returned and did a short prison term. And then he got into a lot of other very unpredictable things. He became a Mormon at one point. He voted for Ronald Reagan. He ran unsuccessfully for political office in California, and he died of prostate cancer in the 90s.
Another really interesting figure in your book, Peter Richardson, is a guy who's probably unknown to most of our listeners and to most Americans, but played a very prominent role in the history of advertising, Howard Gossage.
Yeah, he was a kind of mentor for Hinkle, probably his chief mentor. I mean, remember, Hinkle was still in his 20s when he began this work for Ramparts magazine. And Gossage was older, he was very connected, he had a great understanding of advertising and publicity, and that became an indispensable part of Rampart's success, and Hinkle was very attached and very fond of Howard Gossage.
Was Gossage sympathetic to the politics of Ramparts as it really became sort of a left muckraker in the late 60s?
You know, I'm not really aware of his politics and in any specific way. I know he helped attract Jessica Mitford to the magazine, but I think he was one of these mavericks and rebels that made, that really kind of inspired Hinkle. As I said earlier, I mean, not everybody on the staff was a leftist, but most of them were rebels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Howard Gossage was that kind of figure, especially in the advertising industry, but he also knew everybody. He knew Herb Kane, who was a very important columnist in for the San Francisco Chronicle at the time. Not really political,
mm-hmm.
but a good person to know in San Francisco. And Gossage also helped, I think, give them some credibility. He helped smooth over leadership snags. I mean, he just was a kind of man of the world, and I think Hinkle, a very young Warren Hinkle, really came to admire him and to rely on him for sort of behind-the-scenes help.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Peter Richardson. Peter Richardson is the editorial director at Polypoint Press. He's also the author of an earlier book, American Prophet, The Life and Work of Kerry McWilliams. We're discussing his brand new book, A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Rampart's Magazine Changed America, just published by New Press. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. Let us do the talking today. And Peter Richardson, another figure who emerges in the book, who's been a guest on this program, who's gone on to have a sort of illustrious life, Tom Hayden. Talk a little bit about Tom Hayden and, you know, what role he played at Rampart's in the 60s.
Yeah, Tom Hayden was never actually on the staff of Rampart's, but he was a very prolific contributor, and on a couple of occasions they turned over the magazine to him and let him write about the issues that he was involved with at the time. Clearly, he was a major figure at the Democratic National Convention in 1968, which Rampart's was there to cover along with everyone else. But the Rampart's coverage was a little bit different, and that had to do partly with Tom Hayden. Tom suggested to assistant managing editor Fred Gardner that he take a week off, come to Chicago, and publish a newsletter for the activists who were gathering in Chicago. And Fred mentioned that to Warren Hinkle, and Hinkle said, great, yeah, we'll do a wall poster. Of course, the wall posters were popular in Beijing and Paris at that time. It was just a single full-size folio sheet with news and events on the front and the back, and they would just be posted all over Chicago. That became a kind of signature thing that Hunter Thompson took up when he ran for sheriff later in Aspen, Colorado. But getting back to Tom, he was an important figure there. When he went on trial for his activities in Chicago, Rampart's turned over the magazine to him and let him write about that. They ran a lot of excerpts from his book-length work that he had on the same topic. And so, yeah, Tom was a very important contributor. And he continued to be so after Scheer and Hinkle left the magazine in 1969, and David Horowitz and Peter Collier took over the magazine. So,
and that leads to David Horowitz, who, along with Peter Collier, seemed to be the heads of the magazine and run it effectively its final few years as it was descending to final extinction. David Horowitz is known to many of our listeners, but maybe give a little information about him. Start with the present David Horowitz, then go back to tell us about the David Horowitz of the 60s and 70s.
Right, the David Horowitz that everyone knows today, I describe him as a right-wing polemicist. I don't know if that's giving him the best of it. But he has this kind of aggressive public persona. He's been targeting some leftist faculty. He feels like there's a kind of bias against conservative faculty in the academy today in the United States. He has a lot of controversial positions on the Middle East and on a whole range of issues. And he publishes a magazine. He publishes a lot of books. He started, Peter Collier was the founding publisher of Encounter Books, which publishes these book-length works with the same themes. So it might surprise some people to find out that he actually started as a Marxist leftist writer and editor. He was a graduate student at UC Berkeley. He knew Scheer from a radical journal that they published there called Root and Branch, which only published a few issues in the early 60s. And then he rejoined Rampart's in January 1968. Hinkle left. The magazine folded, actually, or declared bankruptcy in January 1969. Hinkle left to start Scanlan's, where he first teamed Hunter Thompson with illustrator Ralph Steadman. That folded after 8 issues. Scheer stayed on, but Horowitz and Peter Collier engineered Scheer's ouster, so Scheer and Sturmer were also gone by the end of January 1969. And they ran the magazine as they saw fit on a more reduced scale, less money, less glossy, fewer whistleblower stories, that attracted the interest of larger magazines, and a slow decline in the circulation.
But it still had its reputation. I mean, it was just going strong.
Very much so, and it still had some very high-profile contributors, and they made some important contributions under Horowitz and Collier, I think. You know, they were running pieces by Noam Chomsky, Bill Greider, Susan Griffin. They ran some sports stories, Jack Scott, Harry Edwards, Angela Davis. You know, it was an exciting time still for the magazine, but the magazine's impact was beginning to diminish, and part of that was because the media ecology was changing. More people were doing muckraking. I mean, once they saw that it could work, you know, that there was an audience for this kind of work, a lot of larger news organizations began to pick up their game. So CBS starts 60 Minutes. You know, the New York Times runs the Pentagon Papers. Washington Post, you know, breaks the Watergate story. All of that was sort of invading Rampart's niche in the media ecology, and it just got a little bit tougher to get by. And part of it, too, was, you know, magazines were popping up that were created at least partly in Rampart's own image. One of them was Rolling Stone. Another one was called New Times, which also had a very big circulation but couldn't make the finances work.
And Horowitz's, the demise of the magazine and Horowitz's connection to it was part of the reason he made his shift to the political right, as I understand it.
That's right. In his book, Radical Son, which has a lot of material on Ramparts, really that book and Warren Hinkle's memoir were the only two kind of book-length treatments of the magazine before my book was published. He had gotten very involved with Huey Newton, which wasn't an obvious match because by that time Newton and Eldridge Cleaver had a falling out. Cleaver was on the outs, and of course Cleaver was associated with Rampart's magazine. In any case, Horowitz did become more connected to Huey Newton, and then Newton actually fled to Cuba to escape some charges that he was facing back here in Oakland. And Elaine Brown took over the Black Panther Party. She asked Horowitz if he could recommend a bookkeeper, and Horowitz recommended Rampart's bookkeeper, Betty Van Patter.
And this is early 70s at this point?
Mid-70s.
Mid-70s, even.
Yeah. And Betty Van Patter was found murdered. Her body was found in the San Francisco Bay. And a lot of people, including Horowitz, thought that the Black Panthers were responsible for that. And so he traces that tragic development, to his subsequent march to the right.
The book also is extraordinary in many ways. When, Peter Richardson, you talk about the culture of the newsroom, so to speak, or the office would be probably a better way to put it. And it seems, from my reading, that it's a very much traditional in some ways. I mean, maybe traditional is the wrong word, but certainly in gender relations and even in sort of alcohol consumption. It's not unlike what we assume of a traditional newsroom would have looked like in 1965 or 1966.
Right, except that Hinkle ran the operation out of a bar, basically. I mean, there was an office and people went to it, but Hinkle wasn't always there, even when he was in town. He traveled a lot, but even when he was in town, he tended to run the business from Cookie Pichetti's, a bar in San Francisco, no longer around. You know, the other thing, in addition to this kind of newsroom quality or city room quality, there was also something of this show Mad Men. Mm-hmm. Had this kind of advertising, 1960s advertising kind of culture that was part of it too, as well as a kind of bohemian quality, and part of that was their location. They were kind of perched between bohemian North Beach in San Francisco and then the media and advertising gulch down the hill. And, it was in many ways the office wasn't – I asked a lot of people about this. What was it like to work in the office? He said, you know, it was like a lot of offices, except that Hinkle kept a capuchin monkey there. And it was sort of flying around, screeching, you know, running along top the little cubicle dividers and so on and so forth. So, you know, there was it's a kind of interesting menagerie. He named the monkey Henry Luce, who was the founder of Time Magazine, who was one of the great critics of Ramparts Magazine. Time Magazine hated Ramparts, partly because Ramparts imitated Time Magazine's methods to pursue this kind of the opposite politics. And, you know, occasionally something very colorful would happen, like if Hunter Thompson came by the office, you know, there was a lot of mayhem usually. But for the most part, it was fairly quiet. There weren't a lot of stories that took place in the office.
You know, the publication came of age and capitalized upon opposition to the Vietnam War, the civil rights, and then black power movements. By the end of the decade, a couple of new movements came along that dominated sort of political activity. First, the women's movement by the late 1960s and certainly by the early 1970s. How did Ramparts, with its sort of fairly traditional culture, adjust or deal with or address the women's movement?
Horowitz and Collier wanted to offset some of what they saw as hostility to the women's movement under Hinkle and Scheer. And they reached out to Susan Griffin, who wrote about rape. They recruited more women writers. They ran more stories about women's issues. They were also very early interested in the environmental movement.
Yeah, that was the other question I had, because it seemed by the early 70s that became a dominant theme of the publication.
That's right. They went out of their way to get on that. So they continued their what I would call a kind of prescience. They were onto those issues very early on, and they did a pretty good job with it, even though overall the magazine was declining. If you look at the coverage now, a lot of it holds up very well, especially on those two issues.
In the publication, then, to give a little bit of the chronology, Peter Richardson, when did it finally go out of business?
It folded for good in 1975. And actually, the following year, Mother Jones was founded by Ramparts veterans. That crew, Adam Hochschild, Paul Jacobs, and Richard Parker, had been at Ramparts. And they were recruited by Horowitz and Collier to try to fix Ramparts. But when they arrived, they realized, gee, we can't do anything here. That the editors who were still there weren't willing to cede control, nor were Horowitz and Collier finally. So that trio left and founded Mother Jones, which ran its first issue just, you know, within months of Ramparts folding in 1975.
Do you think Ramparts was, to some extent, a function of the dynamism of the 1960s and faded when that dynamism faded, everything else being equal?
I think so. I think it would have been hard to sustain what they were doing in any case. There was a circus-like quality about it. Part of that can be traced to Hinkle. I think he wanted a circus. I don't think it would have had the impact if they had played it safer. And I don't think they were very interested in building a monument. I don't think anybody really cared if it stayed around for 150 years, like The Nation or Atlantic Monthly, that wasn't any part of their aspiration. I don't think they wanted to do what they were doing, and they were just trying to figure out ways that they could do it as long as they could. But there was a desire to keep it alive. Horowitz, especially. In 69, when it was going under, was adamant, we need to keep this alive. This is a very important magazine. But as the 70s wore on, they realized, you know, this